Well, thank you very much for your invitation. I'm glad to see that many of you have removed your jackets because the Irish have a reputation sometimes for generating more heat than light. But I'm delighted to see that having arrived here at your invitation, I do not find myself like the bishop who came to the little country church and to his utter horror and astonishment as he mounted the pulpit, he saw there were only two people in the audience. And he whispered to the vicar as he was climbing the pulpit stairs, "Did you tell them I was coming?" He said, "No, but word seems to have got around." So it's lovely to see so many of you, which proves to me again the importance of this subject. Has science buried God? And I want to approach it this evening from the perspective that just as the Christian Institute here is interested in the public understanding of Christianity, so I am interested in the public understanding of science and how that affects people's concept of God. And as our chairman has reminded us, there are a number of very vocal scientists in Britain and elsewhere, who are very clear as to what the true position is. For example, Peter Atkins, professor of chemistry at Oxford, says humanity should accept that science has eliminated the justification for believing in cosmic purpose, and that any survival of purpose is inspired only by sentiment. And Richard Dawkins, as ever, goes further than anybody else and points out, in his opinion, that faith is one of the world's great evils, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. And this is not simply an intellectual issue. It has a very significant moral dimension. And there are scientists like Professor Will Provine of Cornell, who's a biologist and historian of science, who says that modern science directly implies that there are no inherent moral or ethical laws, no absolute guiding principles for human society. See, we cannot evade the moral implications of some of the things that leading and vocal scientists are saying. And the net impression that the public gets so very often in my experience is that science is at war with religion. And one of my main theses tonight is this, that the battle is not really between science and religion, but it is actually between two worldviews. The real conflict is between materialism and theism. Let's take two typical theistic statements. The famous one with which the Bible begins, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." And then, in reference to human beings, "God created man and woman in his own image." Contrast that with the statement of Carl Sagan, the astronomer, "The cosmos is all there is or was or ever shall be." And with reference to humanity, the statement of biologist George Gaylord Simpson of Harvard, "Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind." The latter two statements are statements by scientists, but they are not scientific statements. They are statements of belief, equally as much as the first two statements are. They are actually statements of materialistic philosophy. Now, materialism essentially teaches that matter stroke energy is all that there is. And so therefore, by definition, human beings are essentially nothing more than byproducts of the cosmos. Opposing that, there is theism, that the cosmos was created and is constantly upheld by an intelligent creator God, and that human beings were created in God's image. And we shall find, I think, as we examine what is going on in the debate today, that again and again we come back to these two worldviews which clash head on. And of course, we have to ask the question, which of these two worldviews makes most sense? And I suppose one of the reasonable places to start would be to ask the scientists themselves. And in 1916, there was a survey done of 1,000 scientists. And one of the questions they were asked was this: do you believe in a personal God of the kind who answers prayer? And in 1916, 40% said yes, and 60% said no. The interest of this survey is that it was repeated exactly with the same numbers involved and the same questions in 1996 by Professor Luba in the States, and the results were published in our most prestigious scientific journal, Nature, in this country. And in 1996, the figures were 38% yes and 62% no, which most people find quite astonishing. In other words, in 80 years or so, the actual proportion of scientists who believe not simply in God, but in a personal God who answers prayer, which of course is a lot more, has scarcely changed, contrary to public opinion. And even at the highest level in science, there are at least two current Nobel Prize winners, of which I am aware, who are committed Christians. Now, it is important for us to realize and for us to communicate to others. And I say that because I spend quite a bit of my time behind what used to be called the Iron Curtain. And I can remember in Russia the first time I lectured to an audience, how amazed they were to discover that belief in God is not without precedent in science, because the Christian worldview is regarded by many historians and philosophers of science as being the cradle for the rise of science. And C.S. Lewis once put it this way, paraphrasing Sir Alfred North Whitehead, who arguably is the most famous historian of science in the last century: men became scientific. Why? Because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. And if you look through some of the names, the famous names, Kepler, Pascal, Boyle, Newton, Faraday, Babbage, Mendel, Pasteur, Kelvin, Clark, Maxwell, these stars of the rise of science, you will find that all of them would have agreed with Albert Einstein, who said, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." So the rise of science historically had a great deal to do with the Christian worldview setting people free to study a universe that was separate from God, distinct from him, and therefore could be studied. And the thinking about that universe was, as Sir James Jeans once put it, thinking God's thoughts after him. So, if we ask the question, is there concord or conflict? The answer is essentially no. Now, I'm well aware that at this point, there are usually two stories that come up inevitably: the story of Galileo and the church, and the story of Huxley and Wilberforce at the British Association in Oxford in 1859. If you're interested in those stories, it's worth reading the recent works of Alistair McGrath on the topic, who points out that far from these being a war between science and religion, they were something very different. It's easy to forget in the story of Galileo and the church that Galileo remained a believer throughout. Both sides claimed to believe in Scripture. What they were arguing about was the relationship between Aristotelianism, which had been canonized by the church, and the Copernican view of the universe. It was a question of the interpretation of Scripture by two sides who believed it. It was not a war between science and religion. And perhaps we need to be reminded, too, that Galileo wasn't always very wise in the way in which he put forth his case, because one of his opponents, who was the Pope, he characterized in his book with the name of Simplicius, which means the fool. And therefore, a lot of it had to do with the very natural reaction of his opponents, as well as power politics at that particular time. And on reflection about these and other alleged conflict stories, Colin Russell, who's professor of the history of science at the Open University, wrote this: "The common belief that the actual relations between religion and science over the past few centuries have been marked by deep and enduring hostility is not only historically inaccurate, but actually a caricature so grotesque that what needs to be explained is how it could possibly have achieved any degree of respectability." And you will find that among serious-minded historians of science, the conflict thesis has by and large been rejected. Again, it is a common thing to hear it as a matter of public opinion. And I think, therefore, it's important in that sense that we inform our public opinion about the changes within the academic world in their attitudes to some of these things. But now when we look a little bit more deeply into this question, has science abolished God, there are two big areas of intellectual activity that come into play that we'll be considering tonight. There are more, of course, but we shall confine ourselves to these. First of all, physics and cosmology, and then secondly, biology. And when we come to the first of these, we notice certain basic things about the universe, that is, in the opinion of physical scientists. First of all, the universe is rationally intelligible. Secondly, it has a beginning. And thirdly, it is finely tuned for life. Now, of those three, the first one is perhaps the most obvious and therefore the least discussed. But it's the most important. Because we are so used to the fact that we believe the universe is rationally intelligible, that we don't really think about the implications of that. Einstein did. He once said that the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. How is it that we can understand the universe with our minds? Eugene Wigner, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics, put it this way: the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there's no rational explanation.